So here's the thing with homemade meals. Eating them is great, but all the chopping and measuring and cleanup, not so much. With new one-pan assemble and bake meals from Blue Apron, you get all the flavor of homemade meals with a fraction of the work. Just assemble the pre-chopped ingredients, bake in the oven, and enjoy. Shop Assemble and Bake at BlueApron.com. Get 50% off your first two orders with code APRON50. Terms and conditions apply. Visit BlueApron.com/terms for more.
So a lot of individuals in this city pay more than 50% of their income in taxes. When you talk about a fair share, how much more than, what is the fair share? What's the number?
I've said that we should increase personal income
so
taxes by 2%.
Is fair?
And my point is this.
Give up more than half of your income. That's
if you're making $1 million in New York City, or more than that, you can afford to pay 2% more. And the reasons you can afford to do so is because that money will be used to better your quality of life as well.
No. Yep.
Because when I speak to the wealthiest New Yorkers, I hear concerns about the cleanliness of the city, the quality of life in the city, questions of public safety. This money is the money that will be used to deliver on those things so that we can ensure that we have a return on investment for all of the money that we are raising and spending right here across the five boroughs.
So that was a Zoran Mamdani candidate, Zoran Mamdani, before he was officially elected. And I got to be honest, Ryan, I would actually kind of prefer that we pretend he doesn't exist here in the Midwest. I struggle with it because the Mamdani thing is so freaky scary to observe.
But he's got a nice smile.
That's the worst part. It's the worst part.
It's good for TikTok.
Well, he's the mayor now. So, you know, you listen to him. That was, like I said, an interview before he was officially the mayor, sworn in at the beginning of January. And gosh, you got a feel for those New Yorkers who are out there. Jeroy Murdoch, maybe our favorite New Yorker, back with us. Nationally syndicated columnist, Project 21 ambassador, and Fox News contributor. Happy New Year, Jeroy. It's good to have you back.
Annie, Happy New Year to you and to our listeners. And we have about 8.5 million New Yorkers. I'm very happy to hear that I'm number one on that list.
That's right. I'm sure they're all
8.5 million.
Yeah, all very concerned that they didn't make the cut. Our condolence to you and your new mayor situation there. I mean, I like I was saying, we're here in the Midwest. There's a part of me who thinks Mamdani is not our problem. But boy, I mean, the mentality, it's going to be a problem for everybody if he gets his full way here with New York City.
Well, that's right. And, you know, as I've warned people, and I've heard people like George Will said, look, it'll be a great idea to have Mamdani in New York City. He'll be a cautionary tale. People will learn from the chaos here that will continue to grow, I imagine. This, I think, is kind of an infection that's spreading. We saw about 3 or 4 weeks after he got elected, the people of Seattle elected a socialist mayor. And she, from all I can gather, kind of makes Mamdani look like a moderate. So my fear is that this is going to encourage people who are either socialist, democratic, socialist, communist, whatever, to run for city council, run for mayor, run for governor, whatever it is. And this infection is going to continue to spread, and it won't be limited just to New York City, unfortunately.
So, you know, when you listen to Mamdani, you know, in that interview he did with Martha McCallum a while back, and he's talking about how if a lot of wealthy New Yorkers pay 50%, he doesn't think 2% more would be a problem. And then he says with that charming smile on his face, he's like, that 2%, it's going to be okay because that 2% is going to go to help those individuals who are going to be paying more in taxes. What do you think about the Democrat Party and their insatiable need to take our money to do for us better than we could ever do for ourselves?
Well, they always want more, and especially when it comes to things like they always say, oh, the rich don't pay their fair share. You know, that's one of their mantras all the time. They never say what the fair share is. I mean, right now, for example, the top 1%, top 1% of people in 2022, according to the Tax Foundation, they earn 22.4% of all adjusted gross income around the country. They paid an average tax rate of 26.1%, which is the highest in the distribution among all taxpayers, and fully 40.4% of all income taxes were paid by the top 1%. So, I mean, does it be 50%, 60, 70? I mean, is there a number that will satisfy these people? They never, I've asked them over and over, what is the fair share number? And they'll never say, they always just say, pay more, whatever it is.
Yeah, so then, you know, they win. Mamdani won in New York City. Is it your belief that the people of New York City knew what they were getting when they chose to elect Zoran Mamdani?
You know, I think some people paid attention to his agenda. He talked about affordability nonstop. I mean, whenever people brought up objections about, you know, how to explain this anti-Semitic comment, or why are you beating up on Israel, or why are you talking about things like charging higher taxes in white neighborhoods, he always said it's about affordability. It's all about affordability. We want to have a city everyone can afford to live in. I mean, his message discipline was actually amazing. He never got off message, or hardly ever did. He also happens to be very charming. He's a good-looking guy, always smiling. Usually you see socialists, they're angry. There are people like AOC who's angry. Jasmine Crockett is always in a rage. Or they're just kind of grumpy and sour like Bernie Sanders. You see Mondami, he's always cheerful. And he's the only, I can't think of any other cheerful socialist I've ever seen in my life. And that I think, was part of it. And also the GOP, rather than backing Curtis Sliwa, who was the GOP nominee, you had some Republicans who were voting for, who supported Andrew Cuomo, who is maybe half an inch to the right of Mondami. He's a very hardcore left-wing Democrat, and that split the anti-Mondami vote. So I think he still won 50.1 or 2%. I mean, he still won a majority nonetheless. But had it been a two-man race with Mondami versus Sliwa, I think there would have been a better chance of defeating him than what ultimately happened, which was that he won a majority of the vote.
So we're speaking here with DeRoy Murdoch, nationally syndicated columnist, Project 21 ambassador, and Fox News contributor. I was kind of gleefully reading through your latest in the Daily Signal, How to Make Liberals Pay More. So I think this is maybe a solution that would make everybody happy. The liberals love taxes, so maybe they should pay them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Look, you know, Mitt Romney is just the latest one to come out and say, look, you know, I'm rich and I should pay more taxes. And then the next sentence is, therefore, let's raise taxes on people across the board, or, you know, people outside of Mitt Romney. And he suggested a couple weeks ago that we should have higher death taxes, higher taxes on carried interest and so forth. And look, Mitt Romney wants to pay more tax because he feels guilty, or he's super patriotic and wants to give more money to the government or whatever. He's free to do it. He can write a bigger fat check to the IRS and the IRS all of his money if he wishes. And what I suggest is something I call the HOT, or hot tax, which is the higher rate optional tax. A very simple idea. You would add an extra line to the 1040 tax formula. It has 38 lines. This would be line 39. It would read as follows. If you are being taxed at a rate lower than what you wish to pay, please enter your desired higher rate, multiply your adjusted gross income by that number, and enter the relevant total. Wire that to Washington pronto. And if you think, hey, I'm being charged 32%, and I really feel like 45 would be better, or 57 or 93, multiply that by adjusted gross income, send that in. And then people like Mitt Romney and Warren Buffett, these other people can say, hey, I paid extra tax, I feel great. And they can have a nice, warm, runny feeling and go to sleep comfortably at night. And meanwhile, they can leave the rest of us alone and let us keep more of our hard-earned cash.
Yeah, I just think it's a win-win, DeRoy. DeRoy for president, I would vote for you. I think it's a great policy. I don't know if you could get that one passed, a one-vote majority in the House of Representatives. The Republicans, starting with a slim majority and through some, I'm not a big MTG fan, and her resignation really bugs me. But then the tragic passing of Doug LaMalfa from California. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no room for error at this point.
Zero.
2026 Republicans majorities, are they going to stay intact, and are they going to be able to get the America First agenda done?
Well, I hope. I mean, look, this is a dire situation. I mean, I think we're probably within one or two car accidents, scandal resignations. People get better job offers and decide to walk away and stab the entire country, the movement, the party, and the country in the back. You could have either the gavel being shared by Mike Johnson and Hakeem Jeffries, which means all the committees will be split 50-50 and not much will get through. Or, if two people leave or are incapacitated or whatever, can't do their service, I think you'll have a tied caucus or tied number in the House. And if it's three, I think the Democrats take over. And as it is now, you have Tom Massey, who almost never votes the Republicans. He's such a purist. You know, he's not willing to say, okay, I'll take a 5% flat tax, because he wants it at zero. So, he's such a purist that unless something is, 100% acceptable to Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, Milton Friedman, unanimously, he's not going to support it. So he's barely there, unfortunately. So this is a very, very dire situation. And the Republicans really screwed up in the elections in 2024 when they only won a bare majority of about 220. Normally, when you have that big a victory by the same party, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats, you'll have about 235, 240 votes historically. They were only about 220, and now they're down at 218, I think. And so if all the Democrats show up, you need 217 votes to pass something. And if you have one defection, you have a tie. If you have two defections, the whatever the measure is doesn't won't pass, assuming all the Democrats show up and they'll vote unanimously opposite the Republicans. So it's a very tough situation. There's all the more reason I think we need to get the Senate GOP to get rid of the filibuster, pass as much legislation as possible, get the House to get it through if they can, and get a lot of these things signed into law. I have been a supporter of the filibuster until very recently, excuse me, but we're not dealing with the Daniel Patrick Moynihan, John Lieberman, Mary Landrieu, John Roe, Democrat Party, where they had some sense of checks and balances, and let's not go completely out of control. The Democrat Party that's in there now, these are the people, some of whom cheered when Charlie Kirk was killed, or they refused to come out and denounce what happened. This is a party that ripped the border wide open. These are the people who talk very warmly about political violence. I mean, this is a hardcore, far-left, radical, neo-Marxist party. And I have absolutely zero doubt that if they take over the Senate, that the Democrats will get rid of the filibuster, make D.C., Puerto Rico, and I think probably the Virgin Islands states, and have a permanent an extra 4 to 6 or even more Democrat senators in the Senate, which means it's almost even that much more difficult for the GOP to take over. Essentially, we're in a situation like, you know, you and one other person are sitting in a room and there's a loaded revolver in the middle of the table. And either you pick it up or the other person picks it up. Somebody's got to grab it first. And the first person who grabs it is going to be in control. If I didn't think if I thought the Democrats would respect the filibuster if they got a majority, I wouldn't feel this way. But I have no doubt that if they get back power, they'll get rid of the filibuster on day one. And then they will shove their entire agenda through, which is why I'm, you know, I don't say it with any glee, but I think it's become necessary for the GOP to beat them to that first before they have the opportunity to do so and completely turn this country upside down.
Yeah, I think it's so important. You know, you can't completely abandon your principles. And to that extent, I have respect for Thomas Massie, but you can't live in a bubble where you don't also enjoy the benefit of reality, to understand that your principles and reality have to exist in the same space so that you can actually advocate for the people. Because if you take your principles back home with you, but you've got nothing to show for it, that's not representing other people. That's representing yourself. And I wish that would be an adjustment he would make. I don't want him to hand his vote over to Donald Trump and just say, I'll co-sign anything you want to do. But right now, I feel like we're a little bit too much to the other side of that spectrum.
Well, I think, if you're principles and reality can't be in the same ballpark, can we, is that asking too much that they at least be in the same county?
Yeah.
I think that's fair, right?
100%. Joy Murdoch, a pleasure to have you back on the show. We look forward to many more conversations. It's going to be a wild year, and we love riding through the whole thing with you. Thanks for being with us today.
Likewise, very much. All right, Annie, thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye-bye. Joy Murdoch, nationally syndicated columnist, Project 21 ambassador, and Fox News contributor. Check out Project 21 if you haven't before. It's a great organization. All right, let's take a break. Fred Flights is going to be with us in about 13 minutes from right now, and we're going to talk to him about Venezuela, about the up to 50 million barrels of oil that President Trump said, we'll take those from Venezuela. Is this like, I want to know from a guy like Fred Flights, who's the vice chair of the America First Policy Institute Center for American Security, is this something that is going to be met with any sort of welcome in Venezuela? Is it like the meanest thing we can do? Are we the bully on the playground yard right now? I don't know. But a guy like Fred Flights kind of knows things. That's why we're having him on the show to answer your questions and mine at 1:30. Go vote in the YouTube poll. Is Minnesota the state with the worst fraud? Yes or no? Annie Fry YouTube channel. We'll be back in a minute.
You know how everything's a subscription now? Music, movies, even socks. I swear if it...
To continue this ad, please upgrade to Premium Plus Platinum.
What? No. Anyway, Blue Apron...
This is a paper listen ad. Please confirm your billing.
Oh, that's annoying. At least with the new Blue Apron, there's no subscription needed. Get delicious meals delivered without the weekly plan.
Wait, no subscription?
Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
We're talking talking off air a little bit about Mayor Fry's comments about let's put a video together where we juxtapose what we said they were going to say and then his remarks coming out saying exactly what we said he was going to say.
Well, what was remarkable about it is that you said most of that, I mean, 10 minutes before he came out and just repeated almost verbatim what you said he would say.
I did not say the S word.
You said bull blank.
I did not.
You said the F word.
I don't talk like that.
You said F word. You said all kinds of other ones that start with different letters.
Hey, stay on task.
But you were right.
Thank you. You were half right in what you just described there. But I don't understand what Mayor Fry did when he came out there. First of all, it warms my heart when people call him Frey. It makes me a little sad inside when people call me Frey because we're both fries. But he goes out and his whole message was a woman with ICE came here and they murdered this woman. And he said he dropped the S word or swords. You know, Celebrity Jeopardy. Have you seen Celebrity Jeopardy?
Yes, yes, yes. The S word or swords.
It's Sean Connery.
Yeah.
Who is it?
It's Daryl Hammond playing
so
Sean
good.
Connery.
And that Celebrity Jeopardy is one of the best things that SNL has done in this later time of SNL. But Sean Connery is supposed to pick the S words category, and he says, I'll have swords for 500. That's S words. The S word for Mayor Fry in Minneapolis was to say that everything ICE is doing is bull swords. And
bull swords.
Bull swords. Or bologna sausage.
But
my
he
mom
said
says.
It. He said it and we were airing it.
Yes.
Because it's an elected official.
And then we were like, okay, the mayor can't handle the public airwaves. We're going to have to dip out on that. Our apologies. Which is good because he went on to say, and we didn't air this and nor could we. If we would have been airing it live, we would have had to dump it and we had already hit the dump button. So I was like, okay, we're out. The dump button has to reset and recalculate time, gather time back up so you can dump it once again. He says in the press conference that ICE needs to get the F out.
Full word, though.
But it was fooled. The F word. Fooled.
Adults are adults. It's not like...
I don't know that that's a true statement.
We're shocked when we hear a cuss word. But it's just, this is the midday, and you're talking about law enforcement. It's not the time for it, and the dropping the F-bomb and the S-bomb really isn't even the biggest deal. The fact that he's that riled up that you have Immigration Customs Enforcement there doing their job, and that they just had somebody attack them, and there's video of it. It's not even hearsay. You can see the video, and he goes, well, I watched the video. It's BS, except he didn't say BS. It's just remarkable, and it looks so self-serving to me for him to get up there and do this because it gets his name out there.
Imagine being the person who is enraged. Before we had any details as to what happened, I told you this is what's going to happen. The two storylines are already formed. We don't know any details, but we already know all the details. The two sides are ICE was doing their job, protesters were threatening ICE agents' lives with violence, which we've seen repeated over and over. That's one side. We knew that was going to be one side of the story. The other side of the story is going to be woman murdered by ICE. And that is what he said happened. When imagine being the person who is waiting for what Jacob Fry just provided. Like, you see that story, and then you get right up to your TV screen, and you're like, give it to me, Mayor Fry. I got to hear it. Give it to me right now. I need to know. And then he says that, and you're like, that's right. Like, you're pumped by that. You're riled up by that, because that's the tone he took. Governor Tim Walz is out there going, everybody stay calm. Okay, credit. He did something right this week. Stay calm. Stay chill. Mayor Fry is saying it's bologna sausage, get the fudge brownie out. That to ICE, that's what he's saying. These are not the same messages. And what Fry is doing is what causes more events like this. He's giving them permission to respond to agents that are doing their job. He is taking what they're doing, enforcing the law, and removing their authority to do it, and telling people they have to they can retaliate in kind, because he is disrespecting and removing the authority that the federal officers have to carry out the law of the land. He's putting them as just people in the street doing things, and this woman was just a person in the street doing things.
That's the way it was presented.
It's
for
not
sure.
It's not a fair fight. You're going to have to do what you're going to have to do. Look at what these agents are capable of.
Well, to your point, you know
it's
what happened?
It's so dangerous.
Right after he did this press conference, we've been watching it live. Fox News has been carrying live coverage, helicopter and otherwise, of these quote-unquote protests, and they've gotten crazier. There's people out there just screaming and look like they're not quite throwing punches, but throwing bodies against ICE.
Every time the right starts to get some wind in the sails, chaos happens in the streets. And where does it always happen? The bluest cities that you can find. And then what do the blue city officials do? Stoke the fires. And I'm not talking about proverbial fires. There's usually literal fires.
There just happens to be snow on the ground right now, so it's a little harder in Minneapolis.
Super dangerous situation. Super, super disrespectful. What Mayor Fry said there. I'm going to read for you the Homeland Security response here in a little bit. But when we come back, Fred Fleiss is going to join us. He's the Vice Chair, America First Policy Institute, Center for American Security. We're going to talk Venezuela. We're going to talk oil. And we're also going to talk about the tactical nature of going into Venezuela and extracting Nicolas Maduro from his fortified location there on that military base where he lived. We'll be right back. Fred.
Here at Blue Apron, we know exactly how hectic school nights can be. That's why we created Assemble and Bake. Delicious one-pan meals that make family dinner simple. Just assemble the pre-chopped ingredients and put the pan in the oven to bake. Then you're free to help out with that last-minute diorama. Shop Assemble and Bake at blueapron.com. Get 50% off your first two orders with code APRON50. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Flight's next.
It, that there's no plan for Venezuela going forward.
Yeah, I know. They're going to say that. I used to be a senator, too. That's what you always say when it's the other party. The bottom line is we've gone into great detail with them about the planning. We've described it to them. In fact, it's not just winging it. It's not just saying or speculating it's going to happen. It's already happening. Like the oil arrangement that we've made with PDVSA on their sanctioned oil that they can't move. Understand, they are not generating any revenue from their oil right now. They can't move it unless we allow it to move, because we have sanctions, because we're enforcing those sanctions. This is tremendous leverage. We are exercising it in a positive way. The president described it last night. Secretary Wright will have more to say on it today, who is involved in running this portfolio. And we feel very positive that not only will that generate revenue that will be used to the benefit of the Venezuelan people, and we're ensured that that's what the case is, but it also gives us an amount of leverage and influence and control over how this process moves forward.
So there you have Secretary of State Marco Rubio discussing the oil. Now, the Venezuelan story coming fully to the front stage over this last weekend with the arrest and extraction of Nicolas Maduro from his living quarters, his bedroom, apparently. A lot of people have a lot of questions about it. And when you're not an expert like me, you just kind of look with big wide eyes and go, what's going on here? What are we dealing with here? Now we find out 30 to 50 million barrels of oil. President Trump and the administration said, we're gonna handle that. We're going to take care of that. So what's at stake here? Let's talk to an actual expert about it. Fred Fleiss back here with us on the Annie Fry Show, the vice chair of the America First Policy Institute Center for American Security, among many other accolades. Fred, welcome back to the show. It's an honor to have you with us.
Hey, Annie, good to be here.
Well, thank you so much. We were talking a little bit earlier in the show. I've got a few different things that I want to ask you about, but you have a lot of experience as a CIA analyst, a House of Intelligence Committee staff member, about certain types of operations that folks like us, we've got no idea what goes into an operation like the Maduro arrest. And I was talking with my co-host Ryan here about, you know, some boys in their backyards talk about being Delta Force and Navy SEAL and having the opportunity to do a mission like this. How much goes into a flawless operation like what our services were able to do in the arrest of Maduro?
Well, it was an extremely well-planned and well-executed operation by the best of the best. You probably saw reports that they built a replica of Maduro's home, which the Delta Force Special Forces officers used to practice on. And, you know, this was so difficult because this residence actually was on a military base. It was protected by Cuban troops. Some of the Cuban troops reportedly were killed. I don't know how many, but I mean, so this was not just swooping down and taking him in his nightgown and putting him on a helicopter. There was fire back. The helicopter was hit. Some of our soldiers were hit. I understand they were not seriously injured. There also was an incredible intelligence operation with operatives on the ground, a CIA presence, I think, that had been there for months. I think we probably had sources very high up in the Maduro government. So it was a very sophisticated operation and included over 100 aircraft to engage in deception and other efforts to suppress the so-called top-notch Chinese and Russian missile defenses that were supposed to make this type of operation impossible.
Yeah. I mean, even listening to you say that, I don't know if it's the tone of your voice, Fred Flights, but I have goosebumps thinking about the risk it takes to have the resolve to go in and do what our forces were able to do and to know the drill, the planning. So many people have to participate in making this flawless because it really could have gone very badly. The story today could be very different than the one that we have.
It was risky, but it was also well planned. It was planned by military professionals who know what they're doing. They know what reasonable risk is. It wasn't done on the spur of the moment. I mean, this was underway for many months. And it is a kind of operation that no other country could have pulled off.
Yeah, and it's good to be on this side of that. I want to ask you a question. It's just something that's rolled around in my brain, and maybe there's nothing to it. But it was kind of strange to me that in Venezuela, there were so many security guards around Maduro that were Cuban. Why would he have Cuban security around him?
You mean Venezuelan security around him? Well, he had Cuban security around him, Cuban secure intelligence officers,
yeah.
Cuban troops, because his country is so corrupt, because his military is broken. He has to rely on Cuba to defend himself. And I thought that was probably an impenetrable shield, that we would never get through that. What the Cubans do is that they provide intelligence officers and soldiers. They also provide doctors almost for free in exchange for oil, because Cuba has no oil and they have a broken economy. So they use services and security to pay for the energy that Venezuela sends them.
Fred Flight speaking with us right now, former NSC chief of staff, CIA analyst, House of Intelligence Committee staff member, and vice chair of the America First Policy Institute, Center for American Security. You mentioned oil there, valuable to Cuba, but let's be honest, valuable to everybody on this green earth. So that has been the latest 24-hour news cycle, a main point of conversation. The left says that the reason we did this was only for the oil. But now we hear the president, the administration is going to jump in and manage up to 50 million barrels of this Venezuelan oil. Did we go, you know, punch the kid in the face on the playground and take his lunch money here? Or is this something that's actually going to benefit the people of Venezuela as well as obviously Americans?
Well, we conducted this operation because of the chaos in this hemisphere, mostly because of Joe Biden, the flood of illegal migrants, drugs, criminal gangs. It is because our presence in the hemisphere was so much weaker and bad actors were getting a foothold. And I mean, Iran, China, North Korea, all the drugs coming out of Venezuela. We didn't do this for the oil. But having said that, we're in charge of Venezuela right now. We're giving the orders to what's left of the Maduro regime. This is something that President Trump told the leftover officials of the regime to do. And I understand that this oil we're going to take, but it will be used for the benefit of the Venezuelan people.
So how does something like this work? Because we went there. I guess you could say you were liberating the people of Venezuela. I don't know if anyone's gone as far as saying that, but that's the way I see a lot of reaction on social media videos. I've been doing a lot of translating of posts that are written from Venezuelans and reading the types of things that they're saying. How does the Trump administration, the United States of America, manage what is now left in Venezuela without it being a regime change effort?
That is the most important question to ask. It's what all MAGA people are asking right now. And I will tell you that this operation was done in the shadow of the disastrous occupation of Iraq in the second Iraq war, when we did away with the Ba'ath Party officials who were running the Iraq government, let the military go. This led to a power vacuum. It led to an insurgency. What they're trying to do here is to try to find a way to transition from the existing government, where they will eventually set up elections. We will vet people in the government to see who we can keep, because, frankly, the entire government can't be replaced. The entire government can't be fired. We found that out in Iraq. I believe that there are a number of senior people in the government who we bought off or made a deal with before Maduro was released to agree to work with us after he is gone. So it's complicated because the cartels have a strong presence there. There are Maduro loyals who will not want to play ball. But this is what we're doing to avoid a situation where there are American civil servants and soldiers in a nation building operation, which Trump is not going to do.
You know, I'm thinking as you're saying this, you know, what was at stake and the risk it took. But of course, the effort, the planning that goes into mitigating that risk when you take an operation like this on, you know, Fred Fly is speaking with us right now. What if we didn't do anything? I guess that was the Biden plan, to say, you know, shake your finger, bad Maduro. You're not doing good things there in Venezuela. You know, don't like the narco terrorism. You're not respecting the will of your people. You're a bad boy. And then just saying that and then being like, OK, that's it. That was the policy. What is the risk of the United States not having the cojones to do what Donald Trump had the cojones to do?
Well, look, this is a narco-terrorist regime. 25% of the people left because of how repressive this regime is, because they broke the economy. And, you know, you remember the video of thousands of people coming across the southern border. Well, there was a reason for that. It was instability in this hemisphere. It wasn't only in Venezuela, but a lot of it was coming from Venezuela. And Venezuela's instability was spreading into neighboring nations. We also know that Russia, China, Iran, Hezbollah had a presence in Venezuela. The Chinese spent billions of dollars to install two corrupt pro-China dictators in Venezuela. And the reason they did that is because they wanted the oil super cheap. So they lost that investment. They've lost that source of oil. So this is really resetting international relations that was really tilted against us because of the corruption and the breakdown of Venezuela.
Yeah. The ripple effect of this action on pretty much every facet that I can think of economically, in a trade sense, in a superpower sense, in a neighboring sense here in the Western Hemisphere, we've seen reactions from Colombia, from Brazil, from other areas around there. I mean, everybody is at least paying attention right now in a way that they weren't maybe last week.
I think that's right. The Colombian government is paying attention. They have a corrupt government who, which is involved in the drug trade also. And more illegal drugs come to the U.S. from Colombia than from Venezuela. I think we've sent a message to that government. That has to stop. And the amount of drugs that come into this country are just fantastic. And they're not just coming in over the border. They're coming in by ship. I don't know if you know that in Venezuela, they actually were building mini submarines to smuggle drugs off the coast of Florida. After they took the drugs out, they would just abandon them because the drug trade was so lucrative.
How quickly do we hear in the United States from attempting to stop the narco terrorism in its tracks? How quickly will that reflect in the drugs that are used, the deaths that are recorded? Will that be something that is measurable and in any near future?
My understanding is that there already are measurable results from the closing of the southern border. But I think this blockade of Venezuela and the threat to other drug exporting states in South America, it's going to have a huge effect on the drug trade. Of course, there's also Mexico, and President Trump has talked about how the president of Mexico did not want his help in dealing with the cartels in Mexico. They're going to have their day, too.
Last question before we let you go. We're very grateful for your time today. Fred Flight speaking with us right now. We do understand that the day that Maduro was extracted from Venezuela, that they had met with China. Obviously, China has a great interest in being as closely present to the United States as possible. It does seem as though this is going to affect China's oil intake. How measurable of an effect will this move have on China?
Well, the Chinese are furious, and they complained at the United Nations Security Council this week that this is a violation of international law. Let's be clear. If we were propping up a proxy state just next to China that was sending drugs into China, the Chinese government wouldn't put up with it for 1 minute.
No, you don't think so?
So, I mean, they're losing this investment. They shouldn't have been doing this. They don't have a leg to stand on when they say we're violating international law. When they're surrounding Taiwan and preparing to invade it. But the Chinese are going to take a big loss. They invested big time in Venezuela, thinking that we would never do anything about it.
And my understanding is nobody knew that this was going to happen until after it was done.
Well, you know, it goes more than that. Nobody conceived that the U.S. would ever try this. I mean, how can you defend against something that you don't think is possible or that no one would attempt? Now that we did it, I think dictators worldwide are going to be extra careful. But nobody thought this was possible. They thought that the defenses provided by China and Russia made it far too dangerous to attempt such a thing. And he was supposed to be surrounded by Cuban troops. Well, he was, and we beat them.
Well, Fred Flights, what a great conversation this has been. Thank you for bringing some factual understanding from a greater depth than we could ever obviously provide here. We look forward to having you back to continue to discuss because we know the story. It's not over yet.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much. The vice chair for the America First Policy Institute Center for American Security, former NSC chief of staff, CIA analyst, and House of Intelligence Committee staff member. Ryan, what have you done with your life? Don't you feel incredibly inadequate when you read something like that?
Well, yeah, I do.
Me too, Ryan. I'm with you.
Okay, good.
I served frozen custard at Annie's Frozen Custard in Edwardsville for 2 wonderful years.
That's great.
Pharmacy technician.
I ate that custard.
I know I served it to you.
So I did a little bit less than you.
Might have filled an antibiotic for you at the medicine shop once.
Maybe. Don't know.
No. Don't know.
Have no idea. I just know that I like ice cream and medicine.
See, where we come in is we get to connect folks like us to people like Fred Flights.
Mm-hmm.
That was the upside of it. You still seem a little down.
Well, I just am sort of ashamed at my life.
You are the class clown of Collinsville High School class of 1999.
If that's the best you could come up with in this moment, I'm still ashamed.
I thought it was the one you'd appreciate the most.
Well, I do, but it's just in comparison to Fred Flights.
You are the entrepreneurial founder of the club for people with high self-esteem.
You're close.
Oh, that's it.
The club was called the Happy Fun Club for Self-Esteem Building.
It didn't get approved.
It didn't get approved, even though we had a teacher sponsor.
You literally tried to get that through.
It almost happened.
And they said to you?
They said to me, no, you will amount to nothing.
You're like,
and I was like, that's why I need this club.
This does for my self-esteem. It's people like you keeping people like me down.
It was the man.
Collinsville High School.
Yep.
1999.
You know how many people went on to do nothing because they didn't have any self-esteem? Probably about 4 or 5.
I'd like to know the names of the people who denied that. I bet they'd like to know. There are people listening right now. They're like, did I do that? Was that me?
Yes, it's you.
If I'm in Collinsville and I'm sitting in a place for an hour or more, people are like, I knew Ryan Wiggins.
Does that really happen?
It happens. And they're not the people who say to me, is Ryan really like that?
They know.
They already know. And I'm like, let's flip the script here. How long has Ryan really been like that? And then we talk, we chat, we get to know each other. We swap stories.
That's great. I'm glad that I've left some sort of legacy on this earth.
No, you literally are. You are.
Okay.
You are.
I am the legacy? What are you saying I am?
I'm saying that you've made an impression upon people, and that's what you strive to do.
Thank you. I feel good now. You can tell Fred Flights to listen to the end of this interview now.
I fear that bringing up your club for happy people who have self-esteem or whatever has not been good for your self-esteem.
Well, that's right.
All right, let's take a break. We'll okay. Be back.
I was too strong. You were trembling. You couldn't handle.
You ever listen to a song like this and think, if they release this song in 2025, would it be the hit that it was then?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because that song to me sounds like it's in a time capsule.
Yeah.
Because it's so synthesized.
Well, I mean, after about 2000, almost any song made pre-2000 to me sounds like the decade that it's in. After that, it gets a little muddy.
Because you care less about that music, probably.
possibly. Oh, I still cared quite a bit, you know, in the early 2000s.
Yeah, but don't you kind of bookend it to like when you got married and started having kids? And then it's like...
To a degree, but I think that there's a very distinct sound that came out of the 60s, 50s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s.
I think of the 50s, and I think, lollipop.
Yeah. I mean,
it just makes you want to like walk through Pleasantville.
It absolutely had a sound, and that you can blend a little bit. Like, did the end of the 80s sound similar to the early 90s? Of course. So it's hard to tell exactly.
Sometimes it's shocking to be like, oh, that song came out in 92. I would have said 87.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's some of that. But I think every decade up until 2000 still had a very distinct sound. Especially the 80s, man. There was some synth that you can't duplicate now unless you're trying to sound retro.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about the Happy Fun Club for self-esteem that was denied, which is really something that I think in 2025, no, I take that back, in 2020, the denial of the Happy Fun Club for self-esteem, I think that would make national news if you wanted it to.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I mean, not that it shouldn't have made national news in 1998.
Not many things did. I think that, man... That is like the type of thing that you would ironically try to get to be a big story. And in 2020, you'd be able to fool so many people so fast. They'd get so far into this game, they'd be like, I don't think he's serious.
You think people would take sides and say, oh, look, these people are just trying to build self-esteem and these evil curmudgeons, they won't even let people do it.
I think there's a whole group of people out there who would hear the story and when presented in the right way would be like, we need to support this guy. Get him a GoFundMe. Fund this club.
That's a real story. I really did try to start the Happy Fun Club for self-esteem my senior year of high school.
I know it's a real story. It's one of my favorite stories about you.
And I think the sponsor was Mr. Randall in Collinsville.
I think I remember you saying that.
Did I say that before?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was him because he got it. He was like, yeah, I'm in on that.
Let's see what cool. we can do.
If you don't know who he is the singer, former probably and current, of Fragile Porcelain Mice.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He is, or was, and is. But then there's a second chapter of this story that I don't know that I've ever told you.
You said there's a second part, and I go, you're saying that with a sad face. Is it a sad story? And he's like... Yes.
Oh, yeah, it's sad.
And I'm like, in a fun way?
So a group of us who went to SIUE my freshman year of college decided, you know what? The Happy Fun Club for Self-Esteem didn't make it in high school.
You tried it at SIU?
What about if it could make it in college?
Yeah.
And so the same roughly group of us decided to start the Happy Fun Fraternity for Self-Esteem. And you know where that got? Nowhere.
My longest friend established a Greek entity that I think they made official through SIU, and it was Alpha Sigma Sigma.
It seems like you could do a lot more with the Greek letters than just that.
No, I think they did the most you could do with the Greek letters. They did fundraising. Like I don't remember the last time I've seen Old School, the movie, but like, this is like the see it through to the end thing that you were doing, because they're like, oh no, we're gonna do fundraisers and we're gonna do parties and we're gonna be seen. And they were black and green, lime green, and there are people with Alpha Sigma Sigma tattoos.
No.
Darn right they are.
Wow, they really did go all the way.
I think some of them might be listening right now. Send me a pic.
Where
of the tattoo.
Where are their tattoos?
I can neither confirm or deny the location.
Tell
of
me
the
lower
Alpha
back.
Alpha Sigma Sigma tattoos. I think there are tattoos.
Lower back, arrow.
Tramp stamp. Yeah. To be explicitly clear here. But I you know, thinking about it, that actually might have been the like seeing it all the way through. Because they didn't take a serious like SIU was like, uh-uh. And they're like, uh-huh.
Much respect.
Yeah. Send me a text. You know who you are. We'll be right back.